Frank, you and I have similarities in our lives in a number of areas. Firstly, we've both been appointed to the Veterans Advisory Council, the VAC, and I'm quite blown away by the amount of work that goes on behind the scenes on behalf of veterans. Did you find the same when you were first appointed to the VAC?
Absolutely. I guess over the last 9 or 10 years, I've come to recognise just exactly that, how much that goes on behind the scenes. And it's just amazing the number of veterans who want to give something back to the community in their homeland. And I've come to learn also through travels. My wife and I, a few years ago, made a trip to Vietnam. And whilst we were there, we learned of a number of Australians that now reside in Vietnam. And they do some really wonderful things over there. And I have to say that when we were, if you like, at a point of uncertainty to some extent about our Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander War Memorial, it was the veterans that rallied and supported us and lobbied with us. And it was just an amazing support of fellow veterans that up till then I'd never really sort of experienced, if you like, and even knew that it existed to that extent. So, you know, I've decided as a result of my conscription and a couple of years that I did in the army, and the fact that my brother followed me into the army as well, and he saw a tour of duty in Vietnam. Sadly for him, on his return, he really struggled getting his life back on track. And very sadly, he was killed when he was only 24 years of age. And shortly after that, I decided that if ever I was able to dedicate myself to assisting and supporting veterans in some small way, I would do my level best in recognition of my brother's time and, of course, my time in the services. And if we could help out any particular groups, just offer a chance to have a conversation about life, then I was going to dedicate myself to that kind of thing. And it's worked out beautifully for me because I was asked if I would have liked to have joined the then committee that was working together to bring our vision of an Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander War Memorial into play. And that was headed up, of course, by former Navy woman, the late Marjorie Tripp. And Marjorie was just an absolutely wonderful person that pulled her committee together. And I had the privilege and honour of becoming her deputy chair to that committee. It consisted of a body of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal veterans. I'd never worked with such a group of people who had quickly cottoned on to the vision and then got behind it and did everything that they could offer in any form to us pursuing that outcome. And it was just a wonderful experience. And that memorial, of course, now stands on the grounds of the Torrens Parade Ground. And we have remembrance and commemoration ceremonies there on a regular basis. And, of course, we have tried to promote it in a way that it is a living memorial, just not there for a print of the service that we as Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander men and women have made to our defence forces, but rather it was one of those co-designed, beautiful pieces of artwork which had this really wonderful, delicate balance between military and culture.
And it also has that balance between male and female because it depicts the female veteran as well.
Yes, and we're very proud of that.
Absolutely.
And, of course, the people that helped us along with that were the likes of Bill Denny, Bill Hignett, Mike Mummery. And, of course, we were backed by Reconciliation South Australia through Mark Waters, who is its executive officer. And, of course, there were a number of Aboriginal men involved as well who were ex-servicemen in Les Crepinieri and Gilbert Green. And it was very clear to see as ex-Defence Forces people how we all came together in that sense of family that were able to tackle that project with such gusto. Of course, I mustn't forget Ian Smith and, of course, Uncle Lewis O'Brien, a local Kaurna man. He always kept the eye on the cultural elements of our discussions, our hopes, our dreams and our vision. And I think with the help of the artists that we had commissioned through Arts SA, it enabled us to actually produce such a wonderful memorial, which I'm extremely proud of.
Frank, describe the ceremony at the opening, because I have been to many ceremonies to commemorate service, but I have never been to one that was quite so emotional and, I must say, very deserving.
Well, naturally, as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that were fulfilling largely their vision, we had to involve cultural protocols, and that included, of course, a welcome to country, a smoking ceremony, and, of course, as you would well remember, we were able to fly the respective flags of our nation, with the Australian flag being the centrepiece and our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander flags flying with it. So that was just absolutely wonderful. And we, of course, I guess in those sorts of ceremonies, do our best to be inclusive of that cultural element, with a view to, you know, storyline being an essential part of that, where someone is invited to tell their story in relation to their experience in the Defence Forces and what they're doing with their lives these days. And as much as possible, we like to have our song line involved. And, of course, you would well recall that there was a song written and sung by the absolutely wonderful artistic performer, Vonda Last. And heavens, has that been a lasting memory. That was a song just meant for that occasion and any time we have any sort of events at that memorial. And, of course, we also experienced the opportunity with the, if you like, opening and introductory remarks within the speech that told of the cultural elements that were involved. And, again, that's just another important element and aspect of the storyline. We have featured the Rainbow Serpent as the pathway from our memorial onto the Torrens Parade Ground, where many of us actually reported for duty. I was one of those when I was called up for national service. Along the way, we, of course, featured rocks who were to bring the country aspect as well as the warrior element in the protection of the spirituality of the memorial. And, of course, we had a source there in which we could light the flame and undertake the smoking ceremony. And, of course, then we had our two guards of our memorial featured in the two sculptures, which were just outstanding. And, of course, the pathway is now filled with the names of all of our veterans. And you may not believe this, but when we started on this, perhaps, vision, there were the likes of the Michael Mummeries and, of course, Ian Smith, who were already taking an interest in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander servicemen and women and veterans. And, of course, they were trying to etch records to make a form of register of our people that was going to be of great value to perhaps our Project Hopes as such. And I think we started off with something between 30 and 50 names all up. Today, I'm very proud to say that we have well over 500 now that we've been able to source that came from our state or within the territory or near state borders, who largely had country from a tribal perspective on traditional lines that crossed over our state borders. And that, I think, has just been an amazing outcome, which will eventually lead to a strong element of our book that we're going to launch in 2018, Call of Country, or For Love of Country.
The same title as Vonda Last's song.
Yeah. Mm. And, you know, I think on that occasion what you're going to see is a top-class quality of excellence publication, which will feature every veteran's name and details about where they come from and where they served, their rank, and probably their, service number. And it will feature a number of those veterans telling their own story. And, of course, Ian Smith is actually writing that for us as we speak.
Does that cover all conflicts?
Yes, it will. We won't necessarily have any specific detail about current, perhaps, skirmishes or wars. But I think what's intended with the book is that there will be regular updates that will occur, over the years. But, of course, you always imagine that the original will remain as it was published. And, I've played a very small role in assisting and supporting Ian with conducting some interviews with some of our veterans and members of their family. And that has just been so enjoyable. It's a time when you actually come to recognise just how much pride it is in those families for their members who, of course, played their part in what most of us believe is, protecting our country.
Frank, let's have a look at why this is just so significant. I can remember reading about Indigenous Australians who signed up during World War One and having to say that they were New Zealanders or Islanders instead of Indigenous Aboriginal persons because they wouldn't have been accepted into the military.
Yeah. Well, I think there's two policies that contribute to that, of course. In the latter part became the White Australia policy. Initially, it was the Protector of Aborigines policy. Like, if I can illustrate that in reality for myself personally, and it would have been for a number of our conscripts in relation to the Vietnam War, you actually had to get permission through the protector, in whatever form that was, to actually volunteer your services and join up in the army.
Right, and you're not talking about the 1920s or 30s.
No,
you're talking about quite relatively recently.
Absolutely, because as you know, that legislation was in place until the 70s, you see, the early 70s. I think after the 1967 referendum, which is rather interesting, it just happened to coincide when I went off to a national service. May of that year, of course, Australia went to a vote on that referendum, and of course it was one of the most successful outcomes of a referendum in this country's history, and that is that we should be allowed to be counted in the census of our country. Prior to that, I think that the only records that might have been taken on our numbers were through, a particular state or territory heritage acts. We were counted almost as though we were part of the fauna of the country. But of course, I guess it would have happened from the very first war that we were involved in Africa, or the Boer War, and through the First and Second World War, that because Aboriginal volunteers as such were so keen to serve their country because of their cultural dedication and respect of country and how significant and important it is, their mother, it is the protector, it provides everything for us in a purest cultural sense, that when some of our people went to sign up for service to our country, they were turned away based what I think most of us would have believed was colour and race. And as a result of that, there were some lint things that I think that came into play later. First of all, our own people had decided that, well, perhaps I better change my name. Smith and Jones sounds good. All of those Smiths and Jones get in okay. And often they use their pastoral company's name or their station's name. And so there were a whole range of varieties of choices that they had, even to the point that I think that some of them even used one another's names in the sense that they would have heard of a Frank Lampard, for instance, joining up, and they probably thought, well, Lampard got in.
It absolutely works.
Why don't I become a Lampard? And there is a little story that goes about that says that even when some of our servicemen unfortunately lost their lives during the battle, there was the occasion when people used their name to try out and see if they could get into the services. I don't think that's ever got any real factual information in regards to it. But people said that that happened, you know. I certainly can't confirm that.
So obviously it was quite a struggle for Indigenous people to get into the Defence Force. Tell us why this particular memorial on the Torrens Parade Ground is so significant.
Well, you see, because I don't think we ever appeared in any data as such in the first instance, and we couldn't enter the Defence Forces under our Aboriginality, so you'd have to draw a conclusion to some extent that that probably meant that, of course, we were unrecognised as such. And so there was a very strong feeling that that lack of recognition was something that had to be brought to people's attention, addressed, and some sort of really positive and proactive outcome attended to accordingly. And so now, for the first time, for lots of us, because one of the things that we did with our memorial is decided that this wasn't a memorial that was simply to dedicate those that have lost their lives in battle or overseas duty of any kind, but rather it was to recognise all of our people who served, those that have passed and those that are living today. And that's why I think it's, you know, I go back to that point that I made so much earlier in some of my opening remarks, that we'd always been committed to a living memorial. Because there are people like me who occasionally wander around the Torrens Parade Ground, occasionally observe that there's people over looking at our memorial, and I can't help myself but wander over there and give them a first-hand explanation about it.
And I would recommend all listeners at some stage go and have a look at the memorial. It isn't just a statue. It isn't just a statue of a man and a woman in uniform. It involves the very ground that they stand on. It's quite an emotional feeling to be there because it draws you in, doesn't it? It draws you into that whole story.
Oh, it certainly does. That's what's so special about it. Because the other thing is that our people, when, you know, if they're linked to veterans in any form, they get such a peace of mind and such a relaxed and wonderful feeling when they're around the memorial. And so many people have told me this. They just feel so, you know, good, which is, you know, what we'd always hoped. Now, I mentioned some of my colleagues on what we once used to call the Register of Aboriginal Veterans SA, RAVSA. We recently undertook a review of both what we were doing and our name, and we've now decided to call ourselves AVSA, Aboriginal Veterans SA, or Aboriginal Veterans South Australia. So you'll hear us relate to AVSA. Now that's a bunch, as I said earlier, of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal veterans who just love each other's company. We have lots of yarns and exchanges and conversations and debates. But at the end of the day, we just love being together. And I reckon that love grows stronger as each day passes because we also achieve some really great things in terms of dealing with veterans' issues. And you know, the AVSA group is just such a talented group of people. We recently, you know, had a lass by the name of Leslie Wilson come on board, and she is steeped in information about her family in terms of their service to country as well. And one of the things that we have tackled has been to address the issue about one of our World War One veterans in Private Miller Mack. Miller was born in 1894 at Rowkin.
Where's that?
Well, that's down on Lake Alexandrina, very close to the Murray Mouth. And, of course, the two lakes that run together there, Alexandrina, and, of course, Albert Lake. Sadly, on the 3rd of September 1919 at Bedford Park, he passed away. Now, like a lot of our First World War veterans, and I don't think this was unique particularly to Aboriginal veterans either, when they went across to Europe, a lot of them contracted a whole lot of diseases that never actually existed in Australia at that time. And Miller was very sadly, Uncle Miller as we refer to him, he contracted tuberculosis. And of course, as a young man of 25 years of age, he passed, he never had any family. And very sadly, in one sense, but very happily in another, people looked after him who were also veterans and of course saw that he was interred at the West Terrace Cemetery. But unfortunately, they probably didn't know that Miller was buried in a grave where there were two other sets of remains. And of course, once our AFSA got its head around this, it had actually decided that we ought to, of course, approach veterans... I'm just trying to think of the actual term, memorials and graves, I think, out of Canberra, where we had one of their spokespeople to come out and have a conversation with us about what we hoped we could do, and that was to raise his remains and have them transferred over into the AIF memorial graves at West Terrace. But policy had changed, and it meant that if they were going to lift him, the only place that he could be taken to was Centennial Park, and his extended family were dead against that, really. And they said, well, look, we'd like to take him back home. And so on Friday, the 24th of March this year, 2017, his remains will be exhumed, and they'll be transported to his community at Rowcan. We will be met there by the elders of the community who will escort the hearse to the chapel. And, of course, that's the chapel on the $50 note of David Unipin fame. You would be aware of that. And, of course, he's going to be afforded a full military funeral, which I think is just exceptional, exciting and outstanding.
And it's recognition, isn't it?
And it's great recognition. And the full service will probably take up to about 2:30 in the afternoon. And, of course, then people could make their way back home again. But Miller's story, Uncle Miller, is one of those of the Ngurrungi Anzacs written into a book that was written by Auntie Dr. Doreen Catinary, and she dedicated that to family. And of course, I just love that book because within that book there are stories about uncles and my mum's cousins in that book. So I feel like, you know, this is all a part of all of these people in here whose stories were told because of their voluntary offerings to the defence forces of our country, and what happened to them in their lives has been told, and some of them I can recall as a very young child and refer to them as, you know, my uncle. And what they did for our community, for the non-Aboriginal community in and around the district of Rowcan and Meningie is nothing short of something quite exceptional. And, you know, it encourages me to continue to contribute in whatever way I can.
Let's have a look at your service, Frank. What prompted you to join up?
In the mid-60s, I went off to Teachers College. That Teachers College was called Western Teachers College, of which I am very proud. Whilst there, I got to a point of completing my training, and around about the end of the term in 1966, a number of us, I think there was something like about 15, I think, of my colleagues from the college on this particular day that actually had to go down and sign up for conscription. And, of course, I made my way down there as well. And, of course, during the paperwork and that sort of thing, I was asked whether I was of Mediterranean ancestry. And I said, well, no, I'm Aboriginal. There's no question in my mind that I probably got some European blood in me. Exactly where that come from, I'm not quite sure. Now, you know, as a person that identifies as an Aboriginal, you really don't have to sign up for conscription. You can just stop here and now and you can leave. I said, I don't know whether you're able to read my mind or not, but you know what? I've got a photographic memory of those colleagues of mine from the same teachers' college that came here today to sign up for conscription because they're in my age range. I wouldn't have the guts to get up and walk away now because I want to stay with them. And of course, I think out of that 15 or so, I don't know whether it was 15, but it's a number. But a few of us got called up, and I'm very contented with the fact that I was one of them and that I served my 2 years of national service just like they did. Of course, I did my recruit training at the wonderful Pakapanyul. I occasionally go back there to visit the camp to see how it's going. I can't help myself when I'm over that way. But
it's that military thing, isn't it? It never leaves you.
For some reason, that's true. And then, of course, from Paka, after completing my recruit training reasonably successfully, I decided to join the medical corps and I went off to do my medical training up to the Healesville campsite. I can't remember whether there was actually a military name actually to
I think in my time it was always known to us as the School of Army Health or purely Healesville.
That's right. Yes, and that's how I recall it. But I'll never forget the experience because, you see, when I was born at Point Maclay in 1946, my mum and dad took me home to what we used to describe in those days from Rowcan Hospital, a lean-to, and or a four-poster. And what it meant was that there were four posts in the ground and then we had hessian bagging that was put around to form, if you like, the walls. There was a bit of galvanised iron put on top of the roof and the rest of the roof was sort of made of boughs off a tree. And, of course, here I am about to enter my medical training at Healesville. And, of course, our accommodation was in tents. And you have fond memories of Healesville, I know that. Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly enough, when we were there, it was mid-winter.
Oh, my goodness.
And, of course, every morning we you woke up at Ravalli, your tent would generally be covered with snow or ice.
It was a cold, cold place.
It was a cold, cold place. And to make matters worse, where we were in the tents, the ablution block was about, you know, 50 to 60 metres away from our tents. So more often than not, it was a towel job down to the ablution block, shower and shave, and then back to put on the uniform.
Before dawn.
Before dawn. But I have great memories of my time there. And, you know, there were some really fun guys that I served with during that period. And then, of course, come to posting. I was posted to Field Ambulance, but unfortunately for me, in a sense, Two Field Ambulance had left only a couple of weeks before for a tour of Vietnam. So there was really no one there. So I was semi-detached then to CARO, or Central Medical Records. And I started at Albert Park Barracks, of course.
There weren't any male living quarters around that area, as far as I can remember. Where did you live?
Where did I live then?
Yes.
Well, in the first instance, I was accommodated at Watsonia.
That's a long way from Watsonia to Albert Park.
Two SIG regiment. I guess, to be perfectly honest, I got sick of having to do guard duty at two SIG regiment. But everybody that was on camp had to take their turn. And that seemed to come around quite often. Anyway, some friends and I got together and we said, well, you know, seriously, this trip in and out every day is just too much. The Melbourne traffic is something like we'd never experienced before. Now, you'll have a little bit of a chuckle about this. We found a flat in dear old St Kilda.
As did a lot of people.
And, of course, we were then only about 400 or 500 metres away from Albert Park Barracks. So we ensconced ourselves very happily in dear St Kilda. And, of course, from there, I did some occasional work at Vic Barracks. and enjoyed playing football for the services side made up of army personnel out of Cairo. And of course, we played in the services competition on a Wednesday afternoon. That was great fun. And interestingly enough, where the Grand Prix circuit is at, in Melbourne, it's basically across the road from where the Albert Park Barracks used to be. And of course, you'd probably remember a number of soldiers while they were based there at lunchtimes and that sort of thing. We used to get into our shorts and we'd run the circuit of the lake.
That's right.
Which
yes.
was really good fun.
Yeah.
And so the Sunday afternoon football was really great fun. And I had the great pleasure of having a kick and a catch with a number of fellows from all over the country. But two I remember very fondly, of course, was the captain of the side. And a fellow by the name of Stan Alves that played for Melbourne initially and then transferred over to North Melbourne. And, of course, a blonde bombshell by the name of Carl Dietrich that started his career with St Kilda and then eventually, of course, transferred to Melbourne.
Well, I've got a bit of a tale to tell you about that period because a friend of mine, Captain Iris Petrus, she was in the Women's Royal Australian Army Corps, and she had been the first female camp commandant in the Australian Army, and that had been at Keswick Barracks. And after Keswick, she was posted to Victoria Barracks in Melbourne. All of those top sportsmen that were conscripted into the military, she was responsible for getting them jobs and keeping them out of Vietnam, particularly cricketers, apparently.
Well, that's interesting. I have to say I never heard of that,
yes.
But very interesting.
Frank, it's been an absolute delight chatting with you about old times and about the Aboriginal and Torres Strait War Memorial. We are going to get together and have another chat because there's so much more to talk about. Thanks for coming in today.
That's been an absolute pleasure.